Thence southward, bending to the orient, laves the Etherian, with its ocean waves. Of all earth's shores, the fairest, richest strand, and noblest tribes possess that happy land. Dionysius. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank everyone for joining me this week. I appreciate the continued support. We've still had a nice growth of the channel on all platforms, and I'd like to thank you all for liking, subscribing, all that kind of good stuff. So again, thank you all so much. Now, I do apologize if this week's audio may sound a little different. There's been an update to the recording software Audacity that I used, and it seems like it's working okay. I had some issues downloading it last week, so I used the old version then, but I am on the new version now, so I hope it's working all right. But if you guys have any issues, please let me know, and I'll try to keep an eye on it. So, this week, we're going to be moving back to the west of Africa and into Asia, starting with one of Western Asia's two major peninsulas, the Arabian. We will also be talking about some etymology stuff, and I may get into developments in archaeological sites along the eastern Mediterranean coast as well, but how much is going to depend on, I guess, how much I ramble on about Arabia and etymology and the peoples of Arabia between 6 and 4000 BCE. We will also be talking about languages, so again, just going with our standard reminder that a lot of this is theoretical, so it should be taken with a grain of salt, and just keep in mind that talking about language spread and diffusion is undoubtedly going to miss a lot of details and simplify things, but it is a framework to help conceptualize and partly explain large-scale shifts that happened during human prehistory, and even, of course, during human history, recorded history. I'm also going to be talking about a plant that I forgot to cover during the plant domestication episode for this season. And I found some new information that I hadn't seen telling me it was domesticated for this season, and it's a fairly important one. So I'm going to be covering about it when I talk about the Eastern Mediterranean coast. So I guess I'll be talking about it this week if I get to the Eastern Mediterranean coast this week. But that is the fig tree. For now, though, we're going to focus on Arabia. Now, Arabia and Arabs, or Arab, is they are endonyms. And endonyms are a self-designation people give to themselves. In this case, Arab means one who dwells in the desert. And Arabia would be the land of those who dwell in the desert, literally. Though, I'm not sure, I didn't look this up, but if the Arab people call Arabia Arabia, or if that's just what other people called it, because that's where the Arabs live. I need to double check that. Obviously, that's not the only place that Arabs can be found in the modern world, but that is still where they trace their roots and shared identity to, at least most of them. Though, of course, at the period this season covers, the Arab identity and even the proto-version of that identity and their language does not exist. Instead, their ancestors are speaking Afro-Asiatic, or at least they had started off speaking Afro-Asiatic, the proto-version of that language. And you can go back a few episodes and listen to the theories about where this originated, but whether it was Africa or Asia, it was and has been evolving since at least last season. And by around 4500 BC, give or take 500 years, maybe a little bit later, a new language has grown out of that old Afro-Asiatic tongue, and this is known as Semitic. And its homeland was probably somewhere near the modern-day borders, or the regions of the borders of Syria, Iraq, Jordan, and Arabia. Now, the term Semitic is a biblical reference. It comes from the name Shem, one of the three sons of Noah. And I believe I mentioned before when I talked about Hamedic, but his brother Ham was used to derive a descriptive term for Hamitic for several of the Afro-Asiatic languages in northern Africa and the Horn of Africa. Of course, this term fell out of favor due to a number of reasons, including the languages grouped into it, either not being directly related to each other or even being related at all in a couple of instances. There were also concerns with the term being associated with some old-fashioned scientific racism, as well as normal racism, and a poor understanding of the timeline of who lived where and for how long. Semitic, though, has stuck around, and languages that were associated with it initially have mostly proven that they are directly related to each other in one way or another. Though, of course, there were a few that got miscategorized. The third son of Noah, Japheth, interestingly enough, never got a language family named after him, at least not that I'm aware of. His descendants named in the Bible aren't as clearly tied to historically known peoples, and a couple of his listed descendants aren't able to be tied to any peoples, at least that we know of, but that hasn't stopped some people from attempting to make some sort of connection like that. As for the etymology of these names, Shem literally means name. Though apparently if you're using it as a name for a human, it meant famous or well-known. It could also mean the common name that people know someone as. So as a first name, which of course weren't things yet, you had your name and that was it. There was no surname. Or say a nickname. Say if your actual name was William, but you went by Bill, that would be a Shem as well. That's just kind of a brief breakdown of that. Now, Ham's name is very much in dispute. I mentioned the racism associated with Hamitic. There are those that think the name might be a form of the ancient Hebrew for burnt or black, and this is why they thought it was associated, he was associated with it as the founding patriarch of Egypt, as the name arose for the black soil or land in Egypt that was Kemet. So there's thought that Ham might be tied to Kemet. However, later theories arose that thought it might be related to the ancient Egyptian word for slave, which would be Him, or something close to that. Of course, these theories also neglected to point out that the ancient Egyptian for king also sounded extremely close to the word for slaves, both sounding, again, like Him. Of course, written in hieroglyphic, they are radically different. You would not, if you were reading a hieroglyphic verse, you would not mistake a king for a slave. They're completely different symbols, but for whatever reason, they were pronounced somewhat close. Again, they didn't write their vowels, so we kind of have to take a guess. So we don't really know. And of course, the distinction of a pronunciation would be well known to the Egyptians. They would not make a mistake like that. They would, of course, always pronounce things the way they're absolutely supposed to be pronounced. Now, Japheth is also debated, but not nearly as much, and the options for his name are either coming from the ancient Hebrew word pita, or pita, which is to extend, which, if used in the context of the name, would probably mean something like, may he extend. The second option is that it comes from the ancient Hebrew word meaning a beautiful or fair, iphi. And that kind of concludes this week's etymology lesson. So just if you see those older versions, or if you read like an older source and it mentions Hamitic versus Semitic, just know that those are all outdated terms, and you should take them very much with a very, very large grain of salt. Now, the proto-Semitic speaking peoples that I mentioned earlier will spread out at various points from this region and interact with their neighbors. Some they're not related to, and some they're distant cousins of, who are probably speaking other dialects of Afro-Asiatic or earlier versions of Afro-Asiatic. These migrations eventually lead to their own language evolution and division into a Western and Eastern branch of Semitic. So you have the Western Semitic languages and the Eastern Semitic languages. And if you're familiar with the geography of the area I mentioned, you might be able to guess that the Western branch doesn't really have that far west to go before they enter into Egypt. And so they also move south, while the Eastern group also move north in addition to east, though the speakers of Eastern Semitic didn't have as much luck spreading their languages. There's not as much of a division in that, at least from what we've kind of worked out. But we will get into all that later. But speakers of Semitic or Western Semitic, again, we're not exactly sure when these branches emerged, do have more room to expand. And one of the first places they expand in is to the southwest, near the modern-day borders of Egypt, Israel, Jordan, Palestine, and Saudi Arabia. And those are modern, again, modern-day borders. Now, these people were living a nomadic lifestyle, though they had adopted herds and were no longer strictly traditional hunter-gatherers, but instead nomadic pastoralism, they were nomadic pastoralists. They, of course, would still hunt and gather, but that was no longer their primary mode of living. They probably also had more than a passive understanding of agriculture, but either due to some type of cultural aversion to settling down or lack of enough arable land, most of these early Semitic or Western Semitic speakers remained on the move and were driven to new areas with each generation in search of land where they could raise their flocks of sheep, goats, and a small number of cattle, too. Now, the future Arabian Peninsula was one of these places, and we've talked about it before, but Arabia has seen habitation before. It may have even been the very first place Homo sapiens successfully migrated out of Africa from, and if it wasn't, it was very near to being the first place. That said, there isn't much evidence of what humans were doing in the area after this early expansion, essentially from that period to the starting point of this season. Part of this is due to the lack of archaeological surveys, which is due to a number of reasons, political, weather, environmental. It's a hard place to dig in. That's it. We know that at least parts of north, central, and northwestern Arabia saw at least some regular habitation, mostly concentrated in the mountainous terrain in those regions. This was the mountains kind of where they're near kind of the plains, and at this earlier period, this is closer to a savanna-like grassland, and it's bordering these highlands. However, starting around 8,000 BC, the climate shifted in the peninsula. And I've mentioned it before, but the Sahara shares a lot of similarities with Arabia in terms of climate. And it goes through greener periods as well. But Arabia seems to see much more erratic and less stable periods on the whole. After 8,000, the savanna-like portion of Arabia began to dry up. And this led, obviously, to peoples who had been living in these areas to migrate to new parts of the peninsula that their ancestors hadn't traveled to or hadn't traveled to in a very long time. Now, this may have been entirely a migration made up of Semitic speakers, or a combination of Semitic peoples and other neighboring Afro-Asiatic speaking groups, or even maybe a couple of just isolated, smaller family units of hunter-gatherers. It's hard to say at this very earliest period, excuse me. In the end, though, the Semitic language, or Western Semitic language, becomes the primary tongue of the peoples of the peninsula. Now, evidence shows that sometime between the start of this season and around 4,500, people had begun living in a number of areas, but one of the more interesting places where they ended up is kind of the same general area as modern-day Riyadh, which is the current capital of the modern country of Saudi Arabia. The site is around 50 miles, which is like 80 kilometers from there. Though nothing close to what Riyadh is now will exist in this area until much later. I don't even know if it would have been ranked as a town until after 1000 BC. Essentially, it was a kind of a long-term camping position. The dwelling spots dated to this season are on a terraced hill overlooking a wadi, which is a seasonal riverbed. Every now and then you do get some small rain coming across the mountains, or you'll see something that causes water to flow down from those mountains, and this is a wadi. Now, according to the Metropolitan Museum, they have found these campsites at a site called, I'm going to butcher this, Thamama, but I think this should be read as Athumama, and it means the blade of grass. The name comes from a clusters of Thumam, or Panicum Turgidium, as it's commonly called in English, bunch grass is what they was the common English name for the plant. And this is a very important plant in Arabia. It's able to grow in extremely dry and sandy or salty soil. Its leaves and shoots are palatable to goats, sheep, donkeys, and camels. And the plant can also be ground into flour, if you're in dire needs. So humans can consume it. And their shoots can also be used for thatch, for roofs, and other colorings. And they also help prevent soil erosion. It's a very hardy plant, and it's useful, and it has led it to being exported to many places across the world. Keep in mind, though, that this is not a domesticated plant. There is no domesticated strain. It's all kind of a wild version. Though, of course, with modern engineering or genetic engineering and techniques, who knows, we might develop a domesticated strain one day. But it's this plant that will be useful for feeding large herds. Now, other areas of the peninsula where we have definitive evidence of human habitation increasing is along the eastern coast of the peninsula, as far south as modern-day Oman. Archaeological evidence of this expansion shows it starting around 6000 BC. Now, there is a little bit of question about this migration. Are the people moving into the region just an extension of the migrations happening to the west? Or are there also people moving in via the sea from southern Mesopotamia? There's pottery tied to the Ubaid style, which we will cover more later this season. It has been found in this region dating to around 5000 BC to later periods. But sheep, goats, cattle, etc., they don't appear in the record until around 4000 BC, or some people contend as late as 3000. So if they're part of the Semitic migration, they should have brought herds with them. Now, you can't explain that by saying that the coastal region may not have been the best place to raise those animals. So maybe people with decent-sized herds, they wouldn't move there, but people with small herds or with almost no herds, they might decide, well, we can live on the coast, we can fish there. There's ways to gain food at that region. Now, regardless who moved into the region first, eventually it will become home to the kingdom known as Dilmun. And that emerges next season, and possibly there might be another one or two kingdoms somewhere along the southeastern Arabian coast, but more on those next season. But the reason this region initially drew the attention of Mesopotamia is for resin producing plants and trees. And this was needed for a number of reasons, but mainly to sail boats, which were needed for transport both along the sea and along the rivers of Mesopotamia. Another thing that drew people to the region was also myrrh. This is a very important plant. It is sought after for medicinal purposes. It can be used as an analgesic depending on what you mix it with. If you mix it with, I think, wine or something along those lines, it can have kind of like a almost a euphoric effect. Not to mention, you know, it can be turned in kind of like a an incense as well. Now, eventually other items will be exported from here, though this will not happen next season. This will not happen until next season, excuse me. But one of the big items, and this comes from southeastern Arabia, is copper. Copper is, of course, a rare metal, but it is important, and not just for copper, but also for mixing it with bronze when the Bronze Age comes about. So in this region, Dilmun and possibly, again, one or two other kingdoms will emerge, and eventually these items will draw people from the outside to come to the shores of Arabia. Now, I mentioned we don't know if the people who founded Dilmun were primarily from Mesopotamia, but whether they are or not, they can't really access the interior of the Arabian Peninsula too well without permission or access or interaction with these groups that are beginning to occupy the interior of the peninsula. And it's for this reason that probably Western Semitic or Arabic or whichever language first takes off here, it's that partly that reason that it becomes kind of the primary language of Arabia and thus gave the region its name. Now, there are other trees and things like that that are important. Frankincense, though I think frankincense may actually come from the horn, and it may have been cross-planted into Arabia later. There is some debate about that. But frankincense and myrrh are two of the big exports from Arabia. Mesopotamia is aware of this region. Dilmun is mentioned very, very early in Mesopotamian records. It's not mentioned in depth, but it is referenced as kind of like a holy place. They think the sun rose from this area. But again, that is stuff that we'll talk about more later. But it is very early in Mesopotamian history that they have links, and we know that from the writing. Now, the exact location of Dilmun, where in the Arabian Peninsula it's located, that is not as clear. There are a number of theories. I think Bahrain is probably the one that gets thrown around the most, where modern Bahrain is. And there are a number like mounds and things like that that haven't been excavated yet, or have been excavated, but they've kind of been hit or miss in what they provide. So that's one place where early more sedentary settlement arises in the Arabian Peninsula. But most of the interior, outside of one or two places, you're not seeing permanent settlement. Essentially, separate tribal groups kind of have their own range that they kind of keep to seasonally. And of course, any people making journeys through there have to be very careful. They have to get permission. Otherwise, it could lead to feuds, things like that. And of course, these tribal groups, in addition to managing their herds, they would harvest some of the raw resources and then bring them into Dilmun for trade and exchange and things like that. Another thing in this region, it may have arisen in Arabia, it may have arisen in Mesopotamia, but it is something that is probably being learned at this time, is a new technique of hunting, and this is known as a falconing. Or falconry, depending on, you know, how you want to phrase it. Now, it's possible this also began in Mesopotamia, But in the grand scheme of things, Mesopotamia, Arabia, very close to each other. There's no way to tell who started it for sure. We do know that it's mentioned in the Epic of Gilgamesh, which was written as early as 2100 BC. Though, obviously, that's just the written account. It was probably told earlier than that. Though, again, it's always the question of, well, was falconry mentioned in the earlier oral tradition, or was this added like after the fact just to kind of show that Gilgamesh is a man of gentlemanly pursuits such as falconry? But it does have a kind of a cultural impact in Arabia as well, and it remains kind of like a, again, kind of a gentlemanly pursuit or like a manly art in that region far longer than it does in Mesopotamia, with the exception of like very high-level elite individuals. Whereas Arabia, it's probably a little bit more widespread, but that's mainly because, mainly because they're not a sedentary society. Arabia has a little bit more egalitarian makeup, at least at these earlier periods. But yes, it is possible that falconry arose here and very early on. At the very least, if it's not this season, it's coming up here in the next season or two. Now, I know I mentioned the Semitic peoples probably had some knowledge of agriculture. Even if they don't, they do learn about it. And eventually there are parts of the peninsula where at least some level of agriculture can be practiced. Though, again, it's very limited spaces. And that's one of the big, you know, factors in conflict among the various polities and peoples living in the peninsula. But we'll talk more about that later. There are, you know, aquifers that are underground that do house, you know, large amounts of water, and you'll occasionally see those spring up, and that's where you get oases from. And oases, much like the Egyptian desert, very important for the region as well. You also do have areas of the peninsula that do get monsoon weather to come in. So that is something that's also useful for growing crops and things like that. Though, again, not always, you know, easy to predict how well that's actually going to provide water to a region. So agriculture is present on Arabia much more than I think the average person would understand, but it's also something that is not, by any stretch of the imagination, something that you can count on 100% of the time, especially if monsoons don't hit the peninsula in enough fashion, at least in the areas where monsoon hits. You do have some marshes kind of in the north east-ish, where Arabia meets the Sinai Peninsula near the Gulf of Aqaba, I believe, is what it's called. That's the little stretch off of the Red Sea, where the Red Sea forks around the Sinai Peninsula. You have what is now the Gulf of Suez to on the Egyptian side, and on the Arabian end, you have the Gulf of Aqaba. And I mentioned hunting with falcons. Despite, you know, how seemingly desolate it can seem to outsiders, there are a large number of animals that would have been great for hunting in the area, and there still are some. They have types of hares that run in the wild. They have foxes. They have a type of leopard in the area as well, though that is endangered these days. And they used to have, and I think they're extinct now, but they had like a local version of a hyena, a jackal, and even, I believe they have wolves as well, though I don't know that the wolves are still there or not. They also have baboons on the peninsula as well. And also honey badgers are also one of the animals that lives in the region. They also have wild ungulates, you know, things related to sheep and goats and things like that. Those are used for hunting, though I think, of course, they would probably interbreed those with their animals if possible. I haven't really done too much research on that line of thinking. But there's a lot of animal life that you could use to supplement your herds. Typically speaking, if you're a pastoralist, you don't want to kill off all your herds. You want to kind of cull them as needed or as necessary seasonally. So maintaining a strong martial tradition through hunting is important and will remain important throughout Arabian history, at least until the modern day, maybe. And you still might consider that still in some ways being kept up. Of course, there are a number of birds. We already talked about falconry, but you also have quails, grouses, larks, not to mention birds of prey like buzzards. And you had seabirds, pelicans, gulls, things like that. Now, there were also other wild animals that I know first. I think the cheetah was there. I don't know if that was a separate species of cheetah than what you'll see in Africa, but there were cheetah in Arabia. There were also lions in Arabia, and of course, the Syrian wild ass. We talked about them when we were talking about the donkey. Those lived wild in the area as well. But yeah, so that's what we have for Arabia. Where are we at time-wise? Before I forget, they did have indigenous pottery. I know I mentioned the Ubaid pottery along the East Coast, but they did have their own style, very similar to what you would see along the eastern coast of the Mediterranean. They were making it themselves, at least in certain areas, though not a lot, but enough that, you know, they would be able to at least transport some water and things like that. But as time goes on, you'll see more foreign-made pottery coming in from the region. But they have their own pottery in addition to that, so it's not just coming in from the outside. So they are in the pottery Neolithic at this stage. The Neolithic seems to show up very quickly and very overwhelmingly in this region, despite the fact that, again, we know people were here earlier, but it is very fast how much this new technology spreads into the region, which means that the people who were still living in Arabia, which I'm sure there were still some, you know, smaller hunter-gatherer groups, I don't think they all just left Arabia and stayed out, but they, you know, they're probably very small in number, because there are, despite all I said about, you know, there being plenty of game and stuff, it's probably not the easiest place to live. And if you're not used to hunting smaller game, if you're used to bigger game and things like that, you probably would want to kind of migrate out. But again, I wouldn't be surprised if there were some smaller groups still coming through the region occasionally, maybe from the Horn of Africa, maybe coming down from Sinai or Egypt, at least in small numbers. But once the groups coming in from the north and from the sea arrive, life in Arabia changes very, very rapidly. And it's possible even that Dilmun, wherever it was, it's possible that the very earliest site where that location rose up, it's possible it's even founded maybe in the last 500 years of this season. It's hard to say. I think one day we probably will find it once, you know, enough research has been done and enough digs have been done. I'm sure we'll find it eventually. But as of yet, the exact location is a little bit of a mystery. And I think this is kind of a good place to stop it. I was thinking about maybe kind of covering the eastern Mediterranean coast. Check back in with places like the Neolithic Jericho, Tell es-Sultan, as it's called, or the site is called. But I think this is a nice self-contained episode. It's a nice starting point for Asia as a whole. Very good self-contained focus. So next week we'll we'll kind of continue from the Sinai kind of to the north instead of to the south this time. And we'll expand on those old Neolithic sites we talked about the last couple of seasons. So, yeah, I think this is a good one. But if you guys have any questions or comments or constructive criticism, please let me know. You can reach me via email at waradrevpod@gmail.com. You can send me a direct message on X/Twitter. You can comment on any of the YouTube videos. I will see them. It may take me a little while, but I'll get there. If you subscribe to me on YouTube, you might see me streaming live. I had a live stream earlier today playing as Tunis in Europa Universalis 4. I had a very bad event happen towards the end of the stream after almost 4 hours of playing. So I was very frustrated to end that. But overall, I had a lot of fun with that run. I just wish I could have done a little bit better. So, but you live and you learn, and I'll get back to that at some point. But I'll be streaming all this week, or at least Monday through Thursday. Probably not this weekend, but yeah. But if you do subscribe there and you see me live, feel free to drop in, type in the chat, say hey, I'll respond. You can ask me questions there too. I don't mind. I just may not be quite as focused on the scientific part of it. I might be confused, might be frustrated with the game going on as well, but I'll do my best. So yeah, thank you all for joining me this week. I hope you will return. Please like, rate, subscribe, however the platform you listen to me on gets podcasted into the algorithm. Just, you know, just throw something out there, try to get the show trending more. I've been very excited by the growth these last 3 months, and I'm hoping it will continue. But yeah, thank you all. Hope you have a good rest of your day and a good rest of your week. I'll see you all next time. Goodbye.